Hey, everybody, I'm Chris Mannix from The Vertical, and welcome to The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, where I check in with some of the top players, coaches, and analysts covering the NBA. This week, I sit down with Minnesota Timberwolves forward Andrew Wiggins. It's been nearly a year since the untimely death of Timberwolves coach Flip Saunders, and I asked Wiggins what Saunders meant to him and his career.
He hasn't seen me play a real NBA game yet, but he's trading his franchise player that averaged 26 and 12. For someone that hasn't played an NBA game before, so I was like, I must be something special. He must believe in me. He must think that I'm going to be something in this league. And Flip Saunders, that's a legendary coach. So you think about him saying that, thinking that about you, your confidence is going to go through the roof.
Also, Bobby Marks, the former Nets assistant general manager and front office insider for The Vertical, joins me in studio. I asked Bobby why NBA GMs seem to be jumping off the Anthony Davis bandwagon.
With Davis, you've got injuries. Team came off a poor year with a lot of injuries amongst their roster. That's how, you know, GMs look at it. I think it's just a lot of it. GMs do get caught up in the moment.
All that and more coming up next on The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Welcome back. We're inside the Minnesota Timberwolves practice facility here with Andrew Wiggins, third-year player Andrew Wiggins. Only 21. Can you believe it's third year in the NBA for you?
Feels like 10.
when you look back at the last couple of years, I mean, if you could tell your rookie self something about what to be prepared for, what would you do?
I would tell him be prepared for the amount of games you play, how your body's going to feel, how to take care of your body, because it's a long season.
And you've been incredibly durable for the first couple of years, 82 one year, 81 the next. I mean, have you felt, even at the young age of 21, have you felt that wear and tear?
You feel it. You feel it. You know, I feel like I'm getting older. My body's getting older. You know, I still feel athletic and all that. But I feel it, you know, but there's a lot of stuff you can do, you know, to get back to your normal self, you know, with icing and all type of treatment you can do. But I feel good right now going into this season. So
when you look at the progress you've made over these last couple of years, what are you most happy about? And what are the things that you look to the future to be better at?
Individually,
yeah.
I've gotten stronger. I've gotten a lot smarter, you know, with the game of basketball, and more confident, comfortable. You know, I know what I can do in the court. I know my spots where I can score. You know, my confidence right now is through the roof.
Give me an example of, you said you're a lot smarter. Give me an example of something you weren't so smart about that first year, and now you are.
Not that I wasn't so smart about my first year. I got better at it.
Okay.
You know, I see more stuff, you know, because they say experience, you know, can be the best teacher. You know, the more games I played, I just learned, you know, like say I'm coming off a pick and roll and the other guy, the guy in the wing raises up, and then there's a guy in the corner that can swing the ball too, or always driving baseline. There's always going to be someone in the opposite corner. Mm-hmm. There's just certain stuff that you know that's going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were just asked in that media gaggle about Flip Saunders passed away almost a year ago. Mm-hmm. When that happened, for you individually, how did that affect you?
It hurt. You know, it wasn't the best day for me. Probably wasn't the best day for anyone, you know, but stuff happens. You know, he had a vision. He'd want us to always play hard, you know, play our heart out. And, you know, every game we play for Flip, you know, regardless of the situation.
And you had brought up the unbelievable confidence that Flip showed in you to trade a player like Kevin Love, the franchise player, to get you basically sight unseen at that point. What did that mean to you to have a coach invest in you in that particular way?
Oh, it meant a lot. You know, as soon as it happened, I was like, dang, they want to trade him for me. I was like, he hasn't seen me play a real NBA game yet, but he's trading his franchise player that averaged 26 and 12. For someone that hasn't played an NBA game before. So I was like, I must be something special. He must believe in me. He must think that I'm going to be something in this league. And Flip Saunders, that's a legendary coach. So you think about him saying that, thinking that about you, your confidence is going to go through the roof.
His memory is still here, obviously. His name is on a bunch of stuff. Obviously, his son, one of the assistant coaches there. But how do you remember him? Are there ways that you try to remember his life?
Flip? Sure. He was a player's coach, you know, always looked out for his players, always protected his players. Loving guy, loving, caring guy, loved his family, loved everybody, treated everybody with respect, you know, never looked down on anybody. A joy to have around. you know, best coach. He was just a great guy, great family member.
When you look just from a purely basketball perspective, to have your coach pass away that close to the start of the season, what did that do to the team early on?
It hurt, you know, for everybody. You know, it was like something just missing. You know, it was like that for the longest time. But at the other end, we know that Flip wouldn't want us to play bad or not as hard because, you know, he wasn't there. So we went out and, you know, we had the best start. We were like 3-0. Mm-hmm. We had a great start to the season, you know, because we played in memory of Flip. We played for him.
When you look back at last year as a whole, 29 wins, but, you know, the potential is clearly there. What do you think of last season?
I think last season was a good learning experience for us. We learned a lot, seen a lot. We didn't win a lot, but we were close in a lot of games. You know, that could easily win in our favor. But, you know, it's just another year under our belt. We learned and we got through it. It's a process. This year is going to be even better now.
You see that a lot with young teams, that they lose the close games at the end and then they learn from it in the following years. How do you learn from it? Like, what are you and your teammates better at now at the end of games that maybe you weren't as good at last season?
There's a lot of things that come down to it. You know, digging in there to rebound, digging in there to defend. You know, getting your plays right, executing your plays is key, you know, down in the fourth quarter. That's when the game slows down, half court sets, and not as much transition. Then you really got to execute. You know, the team that executes and rebounds usually wins the game.
There's a lot of excitement about this team around the league because of all the young talent that you guys have here. But maybe nobody's more intriguing than you and Carl and how you two develop as kind of a tandem moving forward and the chemistry that you two have and hopefully will have in the future. How would you evaluate that chemistry between the two of you over the last year plus?
It's been building. You know, even his first year here, you know, we were close. You know, Carl's a guy that you just get close to. He talks a lot. He's everywhere. You know, he's talking to everybody. He's a people's person, you know, so you're going to get a, you know, some type of relationship with them, you know, and it's been growing on and off the court. We hang out off the court. On the court, we start, you know, me and him have big roles on the team, you know, so that chemistry is building every day.
When a guy like that comes to the team, do you wonder, am I going to like him? Am I going to be friends with him? Does that go through your mind at all?
Not really. You might think when you don't know him, like before he got drafted and stuff, or when he got drafted, you might think, how is he going to be? But I had the chance to play for him in high school. Mm-hmm. For a game, Hoop Summer games, and I was his roommate, so I knew how he was already, so I was excited.
And did you know then that he was a good guy and you'd like to be around him?
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And on the court, I mean, as you look at what you guys were able to do last year, what stands out as positives? What stands out to you as stuff you're going to be working on?
Pardon me?
When you look at what you guys did on the court last year, as you try to develop that on-the-court chemistry, what were some of the positives of that, and what's something you think you need to work on?
We did a lot of great things, you know, in like the two-man game, you know, and when the time's running out, fourth quarter, we had a lot of great plays, a lot of great plays. And this year, coaches put us in a lot of different positions to do even better plays, you know, to be even better.
Is there, you said the two-man game type of plays, is there like a play or a set or something offensively that you can see, you know, Ian started last year and going forward, that's going to be your bread and butter with him?
The thing is, our end of, like, end of possession plays all usually end up in the same thing, really. You know, but every play we got, it consists of the guard and the big men with a screening roll or a handoff or something. So I'm getting involved with Carl either way, whether I like it or not. We're going to have the opportunity on the play to make something happen.
You have a new coach, and I want to talk about a little bit about what he's brought to this team so far. But, you know, I noticed even just now, Tom talking to you and Carl on the practice floor. How much does he talk to you two as the young leaders of this team, and what does he talk to you about?
A lot. He pushes us a lot. You know, he talks to us about leadership, about how's the team doing? What do you guys think about practice? He's always asking us, you know, he wants, like, it feels like he wants to get better at what he's doing, and he's teaching us a lot. We want to get better, you know? So we're all building a great, great, you know, relationship, you know, and he'll take us in his office and talk to us, watch film with us, the head coach watching film with you, you know? So it tells you a lot.
When he talks to you about leadership, what does he expect from you?
He expects to play hard, talk, pick everybody up. You know, he always says, you know, how you, Carl, and Zach play, that's going to set the standard for everybody else. If you guys play hard, it's going to make everyone else rise. If you guys don't play hard, people are going to think they don't have to play hard. You guys aren't playing hard. So he always tells us, you guys have to play hard. You guys are the reason you make the team go.
So it's more of a leadership by example thing as opposed to vocally, or?
I feel like there's a lot of people are leaders in different ways on this team. Like Ricky, he's a great vocal leader. You know, he talks, he gets everyone involved. Carl's a great vocal leader. I feel like I'm better at leading by example than leading vocally. Mm-hmm. Those guys are louder than me. Mm-hmm. But my leading by example, what I do, it speaks volumes itself.
So when Tom Thibodeau takes over this team, he was telling me yesterday that he wanted all you guys around in April. Were you there for that when he first got the job? Did you have a meeting? What were your first impressions of him when that first meeting happened?
I was excited, you know, what he was saying, his vision for the team and how excited he was, you know, that got me happy and excited.
Mm-hmm. What was he telling you guys about his vision for the team and specifically for you when the off season starts and he knows he's going to be gone for 6 weeks, 7 weeks, whatever it is with USA Basketball? What did he tell you specifically about what he'd like to see you do in the off season?
Oh, not like going into next season?
Going into next season, yeah.
Oh, he said he just wanted me to take over. He wanted me to be a leader. You know, he wanted me to do more. He wanted me to rebound, do everything I can for the team. You know, just assert myself. He wants me to do everything. Everything I can possibly do in the court, he wants me to do.
He's got a great reputation in terms of success. The Chicago teams, their records speak to themselves. He's known as a tough coach, as a tough, demanding coach. Are you the type of guy, do you ask around to players that used to play for him and ask them what they thought about him? Did you do any research on who Tom was?
I knew. I didn't ask around. I don't know too much. I don't have a relationship with like a bunch of players around the league, so I didn't like, you know, ask them. But I knew who he was before he came here. I knew his history, his track record, you know, and he's proven, you know, he's certified, you know, he's done stuff for, you know, teams that, you know, other coaches couldn't do.
He was telling me he brought the team to Vegas, the whole team to Vegas during summer league. What was that week or so, whatever it was, like for you and your team?
It was great. You know, we got a chance to work out and then we got a chance to watch, you know, the rookie do his thing in summer league.
Mm-hmm. When you're working out together, are you eating together? Is it a bonding type of experience for you guys, or is it just about basketball?
Right now?
No, when in the summer league, when you're there.
I feel like it was more, summer league was, we were focused more on, you know, the summer league team and the rookies and stuff like that. I think now that we are the regular season and our actual team, now we do a lot of like team stuff. Mm-hmm. We go out to eat, we go out to movies, we do all types of stuff.
So he's a yeller. I mean, I thought he was going to get thrown out of the game Friday night. Yeah. I mean, it's a preseason game and he's going in on the referees that game. I mean, have you had the maybe unpleasant experience of getting yelled at this point?
I don't even really notice it. it happens a lot. It happens a lot. You know, that's his tone of voice. You know, you got to listen to the message, not the tone with him. Mm-hmm. So that's what I listen to.
He's got a great reputation for preparation. You know, even guys like John Lucas have told me in the past that, and other guys, Jimmy Butler, have said that when they walk into a pregame meeting and that stuff is on the whiteboard, whatever the game plan is, they know if they follow it, they're going to have success with it. What have you noticed about his preparation, and does it differentiate at all from anyone else you played for?
Is very consistent, and I was different from the other coaches I've seen. You know, it's different. There's a bunch of stuff, everything you can think of is on the board. Mm-hmm. And we go through it all every time. So it's a routine. He doesn't miss nothing. It's always the same. He stays very consistent with his work.
Does that make it better for you? That's a lot of information. Is it better for you to have that information to absorb it?
Definitely better for us to have it, because we know what's going to work, what's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Just lastly, the where you are in Minnesota. I mean, you mentioned you're 3 years in already. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. At 21, you're 3 years in. Is this a situation you like being in when you think of whatever your long-term future is going to look like? Does it look like it in Minnesota?
Yeah. For me, I'd want to stay here for as long as they want me. And mm-hmm. I want to be here. Mm-hmm. You know, I love it here. I love the city. I love the fans. I built a relationship with everyone in here, mm-hmm. everyone that works here. So I love it here. I'd want to be here forever.
Coaches don't like to put numbers on what they might do this season or expectations on a season. But do you personally have expectations both for what you want to do and for what you hope this team is going to do this year?
I just want to make the playoffs. That's the main thing. Mm-hmm. If we do that, then, you know, our goal is complete, you know, because we know we're only going to build from there.
Losing's got to just suck for a guy that's won as much as you have.
Losing is it's never fun. It's the worst thing that can happen, losing. No one likes it.
Well, Andrew, thanks for joining me here. I really appreciate you taking some time to stop by.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. It's the MMQB Podcast with Peter King.
This is about 5 years ago. There we are at dinner. Donald Trump is telling one of his million stories about his beautiful acreage and his golf course and all his business. And right behind me and my wife and everybody else, some 6'4" brunette walks in the room. And he goes, wow, stops telling the story. She's beautiful. We all looked at her, then looked back at him. He finished his story.
For the rest of this conversation with Rich Eisen, please search the MMQB Podcast with Peter King to listen and subscribe.
All right, we're back, and we're back here in our New York studios. The NBA season is kicking off tonight. A couple of games tonight. The full season kind of starts in earnest on Wednesday. And to join me and talk more about that is Bobby Marks, the front office insider for the Vertical, former assistant GM with the Brooklyn Nets. Bobby, we've seen in the last 72 hours or so a lot of those end of the roster transactions. The fight for the 15th man spots have been completed over the last couple of days. You've been involved in those fights. You've had to be part of cutting players. What are those roster battles like for an executive?
Well, it's not easy, and I think that's why you saw a lot of teams take up till Monday. You can submit your rosters by 5 o'clock and make those final final waivers. And it's, you have to look at it from a job perspective. It's almost like you're firing an employee. It's a little bit different now just based on how the D-League has taken off, that a lot of these players that have come into camp are under the impression, either from their agent or from the team, that there's an affiliate. If you're the Yogi Ferrells of the, who was in the Nets camp, he'll be playing for the Long Island team. The hard part is that what we saw was some of these first rounders that just got cut. The Jordan Adams, the Mitch McGarrys, the RJ Hunters, RJ Goodwin. That is a hard pill to swallow. Former first round draft picks, in some cases Hunter on his only on a second year, getting waived there, and it's basically you just face a numbers crunch.
Yeah, I mean that maybe the most marquee, if you want to call it that, 15th man fight was RJ Hunter and James Young in Boston, two first round picks that the Celtics just and neither one of these guys distinguished themselves over the first couple of years or the last couple of years of their career. But to see, you're right, first round picks having to swallow that kind of financial pill, that can't be fun for an executive. But look, you've cut players, been part of cutting players in the past. Any cuts stand out to you? Any moments that you remember from your days of telling a guy he's got to go?
Well, the one thing you can't do is cut a player by yourself. Because, and if you're going to do it, you better make sure the door's unlocked, because you don't want any long after effect. But I've been in a room, when I was either worked for Rod Thorne or Billy King most recently, where you're in the room sitting there. You know, most of these players take it pretty well. There is a sense of, disappointment on their face. Today, the Monday cut down date is the hardest, just because you've gotten them to like almost the finish line, and to do it, with the season, especially when you're going to play a game in 2 days, that is really hard.
Now, I want to get to the Golden State Warriors and how do you exactly stop them in some ways? Even the Cleveland Cavaliers, same thing. But the news of the last week or so has involved the collective bargaining agreement, and we now seem more likely than not, I guess it's safe to say, to have a new deal. Our colleague Adrian Wojnarowski reported yesterday that it's a 7-year deal that the league is negotiating, with a 6-year opt-out, which would presumably give the league labor peace through around 2023, possibly 2024. I mean, how big is it for the league to get this done now, you know, 8-9 months ahead of when that, you know, artificial deadline of potentially missing games exists?
Well, it's big just because I think if you get past that December 15th opt-out date that both sides have, then you go into some uncharted waters because you don't know if you're going to be able to get something done during the season. I think when we look back at 2011, both sides let this thing prolong to the summer, figured out they'd be able to get a deal done within a couple months, and then you know we get to you know end of September and there's no deal. So to get something this quick is big, just for harmony within the league. It sets a really good example to the other leagues, the NFL, to the Major League Baseball, to NHL, that there is a product right now that is worth watching. You know, money is as good as ever from a player standpoint, but you know, I've never seen, and I've been part of, I guess, four different collective bargaining agreements to get a deal done this quickly.
From what you know of the details that have emerged to this point, what's the most compelling? What do you think is going to be the most important parts of this deal that have come out to this point?
Well, the one thing that's going to be interesting, and it's going to be interesting from a point of, is it's the cap holds, and it's there's going to be an increase in the cap hold. It's based on how your free agent status is, but there's reports that it could be up to 300%. The big question will be: is it will be grandfathered in? Will start right away? Will be some type of grace period? We saw it with the tax a couple in 2011 that the league let a 2-year window go. Because if it isn't, and if it starts right away in July, Steph Curry, his cap hold is going to be huge. That's one of the benefits of him being on such a low salary. Will he be able to afford Livingston and Iguodala, especially with Durant as a free agent? That they didn't, you know, that's put into place because we saw this summer, Drummond, Beal, players who eventually signed max deals. Both teams, Washington and Detroit, used cap space, signed players. Circle back, used a max level to sign each guy. That's going to go away. You're going to see rookie scale contracts go up 45%.
So how does that go away, though? Tell me how teams, you know, I know what you mean because, you know, they have these under the table agreements. We're going to give you a max deal. We're going to do this. But how do they make it go away?
Well, it's going to be at such a higher number. From what I understand is that it's going to be kind of broken into two criteria. If you are making more than $8 million, your cap hold is going to be 300%. If you're making below $8 million, it's going to be 250%. So it still will be in play. There'll still be somewhat of a loophole possibly here. But it goes away from basically you're going to have to figure out your own players first before you can go into free agency and use the room. The days of those, you know, bargain contracts, $8, $9 million guys are going to be kind of out the window.
We know that the NBA hates super teams. They don't want the balance of power to reside in one location as it does right now with Golden State and to a lesser degree with Cleveland. The details that you do know, how does it work or does it work against a team like the Warriors or against a team like the Cavaliers?
Well, for Cleveland, they're fine. Their players are locked up for the future. And I think what you're going to see is that you're not going to see the fruits of this deal until probably 2018, possibly. I think you're going to see less player movement from a free agent standpoint, possibly more from a trade aspect. You're going to see teams locked into this group. Likely not going to see the amnesty provision. That's your get out of jail free card to get some cap relief. The cap's going to flatline here. We'll go up to probably 102, 103 this upcoming summer, and then it's basically going to be 105, 106. In that, it's not going to take that drastic jump like we saw this past July. So for teams that spent a lot of money this summer, you better hope that what your product you put on the floor and how this season turns out is going to be good enough, because you might be locked in with these players.
We look at all the money the players are making, and it's astronomical, and it's what makes headlines on Twitter, on the Vertical, everything else. But it should be noted as obvious that owners are making more. Like, they're making more money than the players have. These owners are raking money in kind of hand over fist because of this new television deal as well. Do you expect owners to have more of an appetite or less of an appetite at paying that heavy tax bill because of all the revenue that's coming in? Because, you know, the elite teams, it seems like most or all, are going to be paying a big-time tax in the coming years.
Well, that's the thing, is that right now we only have two teams in the tax. We have Cleveland and we have the Clippers, who are repeater tax, and their numbers aren't that high just because of how high the threshold is, though. But we're looking at, this is going to catch up to everybody. We're looking at Portland next year, possibly. You still have to sign Mason Plumlee, possibly $150 million payroll, and then another $90 million in the tax. Clippers, another team, Griffin, Paul, Redick, repeater tax team, same thing as Portland. And that's why it's so important for the Trailblazers to stay under the tax this year, because there's a chance they could be in the tax next 3 or 4 years and try to get that you know, I guess, flexibility you know, in the future.
Honestly, basketball in some ways has come to remind me of the NFL in the sense that NFL teams, if they have guys that get a little bit older, they're not afraid to let them go to because they have cheaper talent waiting in the wings. It just makes, to me, it makes the draft that much more important. It makes hitting on these draft picks that much more important. I mean, one guy we've been talking about, not just us, but everybody across the league, you know, quietly, Patrick McCaw, the kid from Golden State, a second-round pick, looks like a potential rotation player for the Warriors this year. I mean, that's an incredibly valuable asset to have. Now, instead of signing a guy to be your seventh or eighth man, the Warriors have a guy on a cheap salary that they can plug into that spot and have him be effective. I mean, I feel like this, you know, these new rules and all this new exploding cap, it just makes being a great drafter that much more important.
And that's the one question why, when you look at how much the rookie scale could go up, is why maybe the PA didn't fight more, because I think it's going to take away some jobs from some of these older players, because you're going to wind up getting some rookies locked up on an $8 or $9 million contract. And how the cap's going to be, you know, structured is that your teams are not going to have the flexibility to go out in free agency and sign a player. So if you're an older player, that's my one concern as far as from a players association standpoint, that it seems like the young kids coming into the draft are going to be taken care of and protected. And I know the mid-level will probably increase and they can hang their hat on that. But I think it's going to take some jobs away here.
I'm honestly glad that the amnesty provision is not likely to be a part of it. I'm sorry. I don't want GMs to get the opportunity to cut a guy they just signed, because there's a number of players out there that you look at these contracts and you go, hell no. I know the money's huge and you got to pay it at some point to somebody, but hell no. I wouldn't have given that guy that much money.
Well, I used it twice in New Jersey. And I guess it was not, we weren't in Brooklyn yet, but I think we used it on Ron Mercer. Mm-hmm. And then we used it on Travis Outlaw. And then with Outlaw, though, he was an amnesty claim by the Kings. And we want him getting off the hook for a good portion of that contract. And it is that get out of jail free card. You still have to pay the money. It comes off your cap, though. But as you know, owners can't help themselves during the summer. It's a follow the leader type league. It's when the call the GM gets is in the middle of the year when you're 10-20 and you just spent $60 million on players and your owner wants to know why after he just green-lighted it in July. That's where it all comes back to.
Do you think, like, if you were an executive with a team and you were $20 million under the salary cap threshold, are you more likely, because of this climate, to say, you know what, screw it, I've got to spend the money, it'll get spread out over the guys that are currently on my team, I don't want to pay a multi-year contract to a guy I'm not in love with. I don't want to give a Tyler Johnson a multi-year contract if I don't think he can be a rotation player going forward. Do you think we'll see more of that, or will we just see the endless splurging that we've seen in the last couple of years?
Well, you've got your, you know, Philly, Brooklyn, teams like that are under the floor.
But Brooklyn tried.
They did try. They did. And I think teams are going to be a little bit more prudent as far as how much money they're going to spend in the future here. And if I would rather pay my own players, spread it out, if you don't reach the floor, than going out and giving a player a bad contract.
Yeah, I mean, forget about it. Why would you, especially if you're a rebuilding team, like, you're going to have to overpay for somebody to come anyway. Why would you give a guy that you don't absolutely love a 3 or 4 year deal? Why would you do it? Just give the money to the guys that are currently on the roster and hope that your second round picks and your late first round picks, whatever, eventually develop.
Well, you're right. And that's why the draft is going to be ever so more important. So for teams that have multiple picks going into the future, the Philadelphia, the Bostons of the world, you're going to build your team because maybe you won't have to go out and overpay a free agent.
All right, I want to talk about Golden State and I want to get to Cleveland as well, but I want to continue what has been a pretty interesting ongoing fight that you and I have had today across multiple platforms, including over the Vertical video that you can catch on thevertical.com. Minnesota, I just got back from there. And look, I understand that when you get close to a team over a couple of days, you start to see their strengths emphasized and their weaknesses not. But I look at Minnesota, and I see the coaching addition with Thibodeau. I see the roster additions with Chris Dunn, who I think is going to be an elite defensive player sooner rather than later. Brandon Rush, who shot 60% from three during the offseason. I see a team that improved in the second half of last season. And I think the coaching, you know, replacing Tibbs or replacing Sam Mitchell and going with Tibbs, it's going to make them that much better. I think Minnesota is a 500 team or better this year and competing for a playoff spot. Tell me why I'm too bullish on the Timberwolves.
You're drinking that Timberwolves Kool-Aid, aren't you?
I am, man. What's the beer of choice up there? I'm drinking that for sure.
They'll be better. They're you know, fighting for playoff spots. They could be 500 team. You know, they won 29 games last year. Can you take, you know, go plus, you know, 13, you know, wins to, you know, get over 500? I'm just concerned. Such a young team, not much of a veteran presence there. I know Garnett didn't give you much on the court, but there's nobody in the locker room. Basically, John Lucas is your oldest player there. We talked about it. Adversity. How do you handle losing streaks? New coach. How do you handle when you're winning? Success. You know, do guys start to become selfish? Andrew Wiggins, X factor. It's a big year for him. The West is always good. So who are you going to leapfrog over? Dallas, Houston, Memphis, Portland, Oklahoma City. We didn't even mention the top three teams. That's my only concern with this Timberwolves teams. When the games matter, we talked about that. You know, we saw them in March and April beat Golden State at the end of the year. But what happens when you're 35-30 and you're fighting for a playoff spot and it kind of gets a little bit tighter compared to when you're heading to the lottery? There's a lot of different variables there, and we can make the case for a lot of different teams with that regards. But I'm not ready to buy into Minnesota yet. I'm not ready to sell on them, but I'm kind of in that in-between stage.
The Wolves were all over the GM survey for a couple of different things. Two questions. One, do GMs actually fill out the GM survey?
They get input from their front office. So they actually do the typing or handwritten however they do. But there is some dialogue amongst people, you know, as far as from a general manager, if it's his assistant GM or members of the front office, there is some dialogue there. Same as the referee ratings.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of different, you know, and it's good to have healthy input because it's a second set of eyes.
Okay. One of the more interesting parts of that survey was Karl-Anthony Towns became the guy that every general manager, or I think 48% of the GM said that they would build a team around. Last year, Anthony Davis was there at 84%. This year, he's like, you know, a Division I football team that's just getting votes. He's one of those guys just getting additional votes. My question for you is, have injuries really changed the perception of Anthony Davis that much?
Well, with Anthony Towns, it's the flavor of the year, I guess. And with Davis, you've got injuries. Team came off a poor year with a lot of injuries amongst their roster. You know, missed a good portion of the end of the season. Kind of that, you know, they went from, you know, being that 8 seed, a team on the rise, to kind of now falling back in the pack with a lot of these other lottery teams. We can put them in the mix with, you know, with Phoenix and maybe Denver. I think it's just, and there might be a different player next year. We might have a year where Minnesota maybe doesn't exceed expectations, and the next GM survey is that next young player coming out of college, or if there's a player this year, if it's a Brandon Ingram who kind of takes off, you know, who jumps out at you, he might be the player. But I think that's how, you know, GMs look at it. It's kind of that hot name. I still think Anthony Davis is a huge talent, and he's been in big moments. So I think it's just a lot of it. GMs do get caught up in the moment.
I worry about the injury issues too. There have been a litany of injuries that have plagued Anthony Davis. He sprained his ankle again in the preseason earlier. But man, he's 23 years old, and he's coming off a second consecutive season where he was right around 24, 25 points, 10 rebounds, and 2 blocks. He's layering a 3-point shot onto his game as well. 23, Bobby. There isn't a player in the NBA I would take over Anthony Davis. And I love Karl-Anthony Towns, but I would take Anthony Davis over him.
Well, the one thing I'm concerned about with Davis is going to be the workload down in New Orleans. You've got no Holiday, no Evans, no Pondexter. You've already got a battered team. You've got a lot of new faces there. So what other player on that roster can kind of, you know, help him along? Is he going to have to play 45 minutes a night? Is, you know, that's going to be kind of something in New Orleans. And you know, can one of these free agents that they, Solomon Hill, Etuan Moore, the Langston Galloway's, can you find another running mate when while Holiday's out?
Yeah, I'm worried about the Pelicans this year. I think they're going to be a pretty big disappointment. Holiday being out with no return date currently in sight. Tyreek Evans is hurt once again for this team. You're over-relying now on Anthony Davis. And Alvin Gentry's in kind of this weird spot where he likes the idea of playing Davis at the five, but when he does, the defense is horrible. I mean, you play Davis there, he can't, even as great as he is, he can't, you know, help out on everything. You play an Omer Asik or an Alex Ajinka alongside him, and you know the offense stagnates there. So it's a tough spot for them to be in. I wonder if they don't need to make some kind of sweeping changes there. I mean, Alvin came into that job with a lot of hype, you know, people thinking his style was going to mesh perfectly with what this team was, but I, you know, they were a 30-win team last year. Are they a 33, 34-win team this year?
Yeah, they are. I mean, if anything, because the West got better. I mean, you can make the case with the East too. So who are you gonna you know, kind of get in front of here? I like Denver. I like the continuity there. They bring back all those young pieces. Phoenix, you know, with Booker, you know, Bledsoe's finally healthy. Knight's finally healthy. You know, the
I
Laker,
think Devin Booker's gonna have a huge.
Oh, he is, and I mean, not only I think he turns 20 next week. I mean, come on. I mean, what do they feed those kids at Kentucky?
He'll be on his second contract at like 21 and a half.
It's amazing. That should be your feeder team down at University of Kentucky as far as how many good players they have produced. And that's my big concern is that the West got bigger, Lakers got better. I think Sacramento got better. Is that everybody's going to be kind of jumbled in together.
Yeah, and the team you didn't mention there, the Utah Jazz, I'm high on them. I'm pretty bullish on the Jazz right now because – what they lacked last year, Dennis Lindsay, that staff, they addressed this offseason. I thought they lacked veterans that could play. And the one thing they went out and did was they got veterans that can complement the Rudy Goberts and the Enes Kanter, not the Enes Kanters, but the Derek Favors, Gordon Hayward, Dante Exum. They got George Hill, who's going to be a big upgrade for them, either as a starter at point guard or in a hybrid role alongside Exum. They got Joe Johnson, a guy you know very well. Rough preseason for Joe. I think he shot only under 18 or around 18% from three in the preseason, but I still think he's a shot maker who can help them out a lot. Boris Dia, I have my concerns about Dia when he's playing away from San Antonio. His record is spotty in those situations, but on paper, he looks like a really nice complement to what Favors and Gobert can do. I mean, the top three are kind of set in the Western Conference. Golden State, Clippers, San Antonio, whatever order you want to put them in. But that 4-5 spot, whether it's Portland and Utah, I think those two teams are going to be fighting it out for that position. I think they're a 50-win team.
You're right, and we can also throw Oklahoma City in the mix too. And with Utah, when you looked at the last week of the regular season, they could not get over the hump versus the Clippers. I think Dallas too, those two games. And you basically had Hood or Hayward kind of on an island by themselves, and there was never that third guy out there. And now you add Johnson, and I know he's a little bit up there in age, but he's the ultimate closer.
Yep.
The ultimate professional. He'll be great for that locker room there. You've got Dio now. You've got George Hill. And that was the big thing with the Jazz, and they actually started playing well when they made the Shelvin Mack trade at the deadline and brought another another point guard in because they didn't get much out of Trey Burke. Alec Burks has been hurt. Exum was hurt last year. So now you bring back a lot of these guys with Johnson, with Dio and Hill, got to get off to a good start. The Hayward injury kind of concerns me a little bit as far as how long he'll be out to. You can't go in some of these prolonged losing streaks as far as 4 or 5 in a row. You've kind of really got to keep your head afloat. Stay at least 500 until he gets back.
Are you a believer in Gordon Hayward? I mean, that's a wrong way to put it because, I mean, everyone's kind of a believer in what he is. But, I mean, what's the ceiling for a guy like him? Can he become the alpha? Can he become your team superstar, so to speak?
Well, that's a hard question. You know, he's a great number two guy for you, but can he step up and be a number one? And he's going to probably get paid as a number one. Yeah. He's got a player option. He's his salary is going to be maybe $28 million. So are you comfortable? You have to. You basically have raised him from when you drafted him.
If you don't, somebody else will.
Well, and that's the thing. There always is. And you can make the argument with Chris Paul in Los Angeles. You have to pay him 5 years, probably 190, because if you don't, somebody will be in New York. But going back to Hayward, that's going to be the big interesting thing. Can he take that next step and be that number one guy? I think he's kind of in that in-between, that 1-2. He's maybe as a 1.5 right now as far as from a level of play.
So a team you like is Indiana, and as one of those, I mean, when you say you like them, are they 4 or 5 to you? Are they 6? I mean, where do you see them in that Eastern Conference hierarchy?
I think they're solid. I think them and Atlanta are two solid teams. I don't see them as a 2-3 in that range.
No, I think Boston, Toronto are kind of in that dogfight for 2-3.
No, I agree. And I think we could have probably put Detroit up there if Reggie Jackson was healthy. Yeah. I think what you see in the East is outside of the top three is that 4 on to 13, we could probably throw Brooklyn and Philly out of it. Or really, it's going to be a dogfight for those roster spots. But I just like Indiana based on their depth. You've got basically 10 deep right now. It's going to be, you know, health is going to be important. We always see the CJ Miles, the Monte Ellis, some type of injury kind of creeps up mid-year that they're out for. Rodney Stuckey out for a long period of time. You've got one of the top 10 players with Paul George, Thad Young. You've got Jeff Teague, Al Jefferson, another year of Miles Turner. I think them and Atlanta are solid, you know, but I could easily see a team like Charlotte or maybe even Indiana with Frank Vogel kind of, you know, jumping in that mix.
Orlando is going to be
you're going to have to, you know, play your, you know, your A game every night, especially you got the East and the West to deal with.
Orlando, that's a weirdly constructed team, though. I mean, that's like 7 bigs, you know, lacking real backcourt play right there unless you're in love with Elfrid Payton, Evan Fournier. I mean, Bismack Biyombo had a great postseason couple of series, but I thought that was a lot of money to pay him, especially considering they have pieces in place there. I mean, you've got Vucevic. They've got Serge Ibaka you just signed. I think Aaron Gordon has to be a 4 to maximize his talent. As a 3, his athleticism is kind of wasted. I think he has to be a 4 there. I mean, that's... I love Frank Vogel. I think he's a very underrated coach, and he'll do a great job with what he has. But the way that roster is constructed, very top-heavy towards the bigs.
You're right. Their wings are a question mark. You've got a lot of unproven. Meeks has been out still with the foot. You've got two centers that could probably start for any team with Vucevic and Biyombo. That's going to be a team to watch as far as, you know, do they use Vucevic as a trade chip going, you know, during the season? He's got a great contract. Does Biyombo kind of slide in? Can you maybe add some depth with your guards? It is a kind of a funky lineup, how they built it this summer. Another guy you're going to have to pay is Ibaka. You know, is he...
He's not taking a discount.
No. Are you comfortable paying him $26, $27 million? So they'll be better. Can they get in the playoffs? I think it'll be hard, but they'll certainly be improved, especially with Frank down there.
If you were in charge in Boston, put yourself in Danny Ainge's position, how careful are you this year with the deals that you make? Because I saw Brooklyn play a few times already. That's an 18-win team, 18 to 20 wins this season. That pick that Boston has the right to swap with them, that's incredibly valuable. There's no two ways about it. That's going to be a top 3 pick. No question. And this is a draft that the early projections, the guys at Draft Express and other places have said, it looks like a pretty good draft that we're headed towards there. How careful do you have to be if you're Ainge about trading that pick or, you know, even one of the other ones?
I put it in my pocket and I don't do anything with
really?
It unless you're going to get an all-star level player.
What's an all-star? Like, say LaMarcus Aldridge is on the table. Is he the type of guy worth giving up a pick like that?
Well, the name sounds appealing, but you have to figure out, can he fit next to Horford?
Yeah.
That's the big thing. I think when you look at names, Cousins is another name that we've certainly heard about. Can he fit next to Al, because
a lot of mixed feelings about Cousins in Boston too. They're not. It's not a across the board. We'll take him. I think there's some people in the organization that don't love him.
Right, and with the Nets pick, it likely will probably be a top 4. They have the right to swap with that. And I would not do anything. I would have probably been a little more aggressive last year with the Nets pick, just because I wasn't in love with the draft. Could be potentially a great draft. But, you know, they're always the 17, 8-year-old kids. But from talking with the guys at Draft Express, it is a very top-heavy draft, loaded with a lot of potential. But you also have that Memphis pick that you can use,
yep.
You know, that maybe we don't know how this Grizzly team will go. You know, is there a lot of injuries? And this is a pick out in the future, but that's certainly a bargaining chip there.
Clarify for me, though, with trading swap rights, how does that work? Can the Celtics dangle the swap rights, the Nets pick? How would they go about trading that if they were looking to do it?
Well, you would have to get the Nets on board as far as from a swap standpoint, because with Brooklyn, you have to make sure that they still have a pick
right.
at their disposal, because you remember the 2018 pick goes to Boston. So you have to have, you know, from an amendment standpoint, the Nets have to be in the mix in that regard. It's a very complicated process. I think we saw maybe last year with Denver, Toronto, New York, that, you know, there was all three teams there. And so it's a challenge to actually trade a swap. You'd probably be better off moving the 18 pick. I think there that could also have value, because in Brooklyn, it's going to be it's a slow rebuild, and they'll probably be in the lottery for the next 2 years.
So it's maybe more likely that a trade involving that pick is done after the draft. You know, the pick is taken, used in ostensibly for the player said team wants in a Boston trade. That may be a little more easy.
That's a lot easier, because then you're just trading the rights to the player, and you kind of you get away from a little bit of that snafu.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the Knicks and what they have, I guess, going for them right now. I mean, they've got a roster that's loaded with star players. I think it's a more compelling roster. It's a better roster than they had a year ago. But my big question, Bobby, and we talked about this in one of our vertical videos, is how do they make sure that Kristaps Porzingis is not lost in the shuffle? This guy is the future of this team. He is a early 20s budding superstar, a guy that I think is eventually going to become one of the most dangerous centers in NBA history, frankly, because of what he can do at that position. You've got a lot of guys on that roster that are ball-dominant players. You got Derrick Rose, whose reputation is as a scorer. Carmelo Anthony, a scorer. I mean, Courtney Lee is a ball mover, a shot maker, so to speak. But, I mean, how do they make sure that Porzingis isn't, like, attempting five shots a game some nights?
Well, the one thing you don't want, and we'll see with, starting in Cleveland, I don't want Kristaps Porzingis standing in a corner looking for the ball.
No.
That will be
wastes him.
That will be a waste, and having him defer. And you're right. You know, Rose is a ball dominated, you know, point guard. He is not a pass first. We'll see how he handles, you know, being out for basically the whole preseason. And you've got Anthony, and then you've got complimentary pieces. You know, with Noah, more of the dirty work. Lee, is there also. Your bench isn't great. But you're right. You cannot let him defer to some of these players, because he is your future. As much as Carmelo Anthony, you know, is their all-star, you know, Kristaps Porzingis is the future of this team.
This is a challenge for Jeff Hornacek, and I'm writing more about this on Wednesday to make his offense work for Porzingis. I mean, this is always in the last couple of months. It's been a weird situation in New York. You're trying to figure out, okay, they're running the triangle, but they're running how much of the triangle? They're going to play up tempo, but how does that work with the triangle? I mean, all of it is sort of it's sort of very confusing right now. I mean, Hornacek, I mean, his primary responsibility, even at the cost of wins in some cases, is to make sure Porzingis gets his shots. And I agree with you. I also think standing in the corner is a waste of Porzingis' time. In some cases, structurally, being in the triangle, I think, is a waste of time. I think the best way to utilize Kristaps Porzingis is to put him in funky situations, try to run him around screens, have him at the top of the key, create mismatches. Can you imagine, and I've thought this for a year now, Porzingis the center just facing down Brook Lopez and DeMarcus Cousins and all these other pure pivots that are out there, even the smaller guys posting them up. This guy is a matchup nightmare in the same way that Dirk Nowitzki was a matchup nightmare. That's how you want to use Porzingis. I'm just not sure that the system the Knicks have in place is maximizing his talents.
Well, I don't think, besides the system, I don't think the roster in place, because you have a roster imbalance, because you have Noah, Plumlee, Hernan Gomez, you've got a lot of Kyle O'Quinn, so you're top heavy with your bigs in that regards, and you're lacking some depth with your wings. You only got two point guards, so that's the big thing. Besides the system, as far as you know, how does that roster fit in with what they did this summer? And I know it looks good on paper, but what happens when you get one of those key injuries? Who's going to step up off the bench for New York?
All right, I'm not going to sit here and ask you to make an argument for a team to knock off Golden State or Cleveland. I can't see it. I can't make a rational argument that somebody in the postseason is going to beat Golden State in four games. I'm a little less certain about Cleveland, because at some point LeBron's going to wear down, and is Kevin Love, LeBron, Tristan Thompson, is that lineup going to work long-term? Plus, they lost some guys, too. No backup point guard anymore. I don't know if Mozgov is a huge loss for them at this point. But in either conference, give me a team that's going to give them the biggest scare? Both conferences, who gives them the biggest scare?
Well, in the West, it's the Clippers, but I say it based on what their roster looks like right now. I like their bench. I like what they did this summer with Felton and Spates and Brandon Bass. They brought back, you know, Crawford and Rivers and Johnson. But it always comes down to health. Can, you know, Chris Paul stay healthy? Can Blake Griffin stay healthy? Can they get through the season without an injury? Can you get to the playoffs without either having an injury or a heartbreak, you know, in a series? And I think if you rolled out the playoffs right now, if you skip the regular season and you put those two teams and you said, all right, these are your two Western Conference Finals teams, I think they can give them a challenge, but it's a matter of getting there. Can you get through an 82-game season? Can you get through two rounds to actually get there? You have to get through probably San Antonio. So I think out West, it's the Clippers. Out East, when we take out outside of Cleveland, I'm going to say Boston, but it's going to have to be, in a lot of these are worth asterisks, their young kids are going to have to grow up mighty quick here. Jaylen Brown, Terry Rozier, Olynyk is still hurt. Huge year. You know, we've mentioned player development there as far as Gerald Green, wild card. Yep. You don't know what you're going to kind of get there. But they've kind of has that recipe we saw last year to beat that Golden State team. So in the East, it's going to be Boston. But, you know, it's a hard, you know, estimate just because of how Golden State has really separated themselves.
Yeah, I'm with you with Boston, the East. I think it could be a dogfight in a seven-game series if Cleveland's not 100% and if one of those young guys that you mentioned can step in and replace Nevin Turner. I almost lean towards San Antonio, though, in the West. I don't know what intangibles are going to cost them with Tim Duncan. I don't know what the impact of removing him from the locker room is going to be. I do think offensively they're better with Pau Gasol out there in that lineup. I think he still has enough left in the tank to be perhaps more of a threat than Duncan was at that end of the floor. A huge season, obviously, for LaMarcus Aldridge. And Kawhi Leonard can lock you down. I mean, he can neutralize Kevin Durant in some ways with the way he defends. To me, it comes down to Tony Parker. And can Tony Parker... you're not going to match Steph Curry, but can you give Steph Curry something to think about on the other end of the floor? Can you be effective? And we've seen in the last couple of years, Tony Parker's skills have eroded. He came into the league as a teenager, and those skills have worn down over the course of a long career with a lot of playoff games. If Tony Parker can be the guy for them, if he can, you know, be something close to what he was a few years ago, they might be able to give Golden State a couple of problems.
Well, that's what it comes down to. And I think when we looked at back at that Oklahoma City series, is that their guards, the Spurs, their age started to show. And from a quickness standpoint, you're going to need one of these guys to kind of find the fountain of youth here. So that's my big concern with the Spurs. It's not with, you know, Leonard or Aldridge or even Pau Gasol, but it's your backcourt. You've got Danny Green out for a little while now with an injury. That Parker, Ginobili, Patty Mills, kind of, you know, can one of those guys keep up with some of these younger backcourts in the NBA? And that's going to be really the challenge for San Antonio.
And either way, I mean, beating either one of these teams in four games, it's just hard to envision. It's hard to figure out. Bobby, always appreciate you stopping by, my friend. Thanks for joining the podcast.
Thanks, Chris.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Andrew Wiggins and Bobby Marks for joining the show. A reminder, you can download this podcast and other archive podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, really anywhere you can download podcasts. If you like it, post a comment, give us a rating. You know I appreciate it. While you're there, check out the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and the Vertical Podcast with Woj. I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.